Starting at noon on AM 580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. The minimum wage debate is in the news again. President Obama and other Democrats have been pushing for an increase as part of a broader conversation about economic fairness. But if you've ever been a caddy on a golf course, a server at a restaurant, or anybody else who's depending on tips, then you know that sometimes the minimum wage isn't really the minimum at all, especially if you run into customers like this.
Come on, throw in a buck.
I don't tip.
You don't tip?
No, I don't believe in it.
You don't believe in tipping?
Do you know what these chicks make?
Don't give me that. She don't make enough money, she can quit.
Yes, that was the opening scene from the film Reservoir Dogs. But the unfortunate reality for many tipped workers is that a few stingy customers can leave them short. The federal minimum wage for these employees is just $2.13 an hour. The Obama administration says it's time to get serious about those wages. In a report released this week, it called for an increase in the minimum wage for tipped workers. But there is, as you might imagine, another side to this issue. So we've called two people to learn more about this. We've called upon Michael Tanner. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. That's a research institution that advocates for limited government and free markets. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us once again.
Pleasure to be with you.
Also back with us, Ross Eisenbray. He is vice president of the Economic Policy Institute. That's a think tank that advocates for low and middle income workers. Welcome back to you as well. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So could you just help me understand why there's this difference between the minimum wage for tipped workers and for other workers? And I'm sure it's more complicated than a simple answer, but if you could try to make it as simple as you can.
I'm going to make it simple and complicated. The federal government, when it covered workers like restaurant workers right from the beginning, said that the employer only had to pay directly half of the minimum wage and could rely on tips for the other half. And so that's the simple question. Over time, it's no longer half. It's only $2.13 for a $7.25 minimum wage.
But what's the logic of that? I mean, what's the logic of why they're set at different levels to begin with?
Well, there's a political logic, which is the restaurant industry, lobbied hard for it, and it's a powerful lobby in Washington. And so they got that passed. And then there's a feeling that, well, the workers will get enough in tips, and the employer is required to make up if, let's say, the waiter only gets $3 an hour in tips, the employer would have to make up the other $2. So effectively, in the law, it is a full minimum wage. The employer just isn't required to pay it directly. It can rely on tips.
And so what's your perspective on this question of raising the tipped minimum wage on paper minimum wage?
Okay. So it's important to know
because if some people would argue that if it's really just kind of a fictional number anyway and that the employer makes it up anyway, what's the difference?
Well, there are 8 states where the full minimum wage is required, where the employer has to pay the full minimum, which in several of those states is higher than the federal minimum wage. And in those states, we find that the workers are, of course, better paid, and the poverty rate for servers and tipped workers is lower than it is in states where the $2.13 minimum is allowed. So it's clearly a better thing for workers. It's a better thing for those workers' families. And, you know, these are women, by and large, and women are underpaid all throughout the economy. They get 77% of men's wages overall. And this is a way to help women, and 2/3 of these servers have children, and so this is a way to help families. It's a way to improve the life for people who are right at the bottom of our economy.
Okay, Michael Tanner, certainly I want to hear from you. Just one more question to you, Mr. Eisenbray. How do you make sure that employers pay the difference? Well, how is that enforced, actually?
It's a very difficult thing to enforce. The wage and hour division, the Labor Department division that enforces the minimum wage, did 9,000 investigations between 2010 and 2012 of restaurants that are full-service restaurants that have tip workers, and found that 83% of them had violations. So there's a, sort of a rampant, widespread violation of the law. It's a very hard thing to police. It would be much easier if the employer were just required to pay right up front the entire wage.
Michael Tanner, what's your perspective on this? I take it your organization is against raising the tipped minimum wage as well as the minimum wage overall.
Well, that's right. I think you have to look at the other side of this equation as well, which is the restaurant involved. You know, the average full-service restaurant has a profit margin of just 2%. These are not big businesses raking in huge amounts of bucks. In fact, 60% of restaurants go out of business within the first 5 years. So they have a very small margin for profit. So if you're going to dramatically increase the amount that they have to pay in wages, and don't forget we're dealing with an environment in which other wage or wage increase equivalents, such as the healthcare law and other things, are also increasing the cost of labor, you're going to make it more difficult for these people to hire people, or else they're going to bring down costs in some other ways.
Just on a gut level, though, $2 an hour seems hardly worth getting out of bed in the morning. I mean, honestly,
well, they're not making $2
for an adult. I mean, I'm just saying that the argument that I think most free market advocates make, or at least people who have take issue with the social safety net, is that you really need to value work over aid, and that if the value of work is so low, what's the incentive? So
well,
what's
your sure two parts of that. First of all, they're not making $2 an hour. They're making at least the minimum wage. In fact, even the bottom 10% of people in the tipped industry make more than a minimum wage.
And how do we know this?
Well, that's according to the figures that are reported, the Census Bureau figures and so on, in terms of what they make. And they probably underreport, since most tip people try to avoid some of the taxes and underreport their tips. At least I remember when I was a waiter and making tips, that's what a lot of people I knew did. beyond that, however, you also have to consider whether this is the most effective and efficient way of raising the value of work. The Earned Income Tax Credit, for example, is a much better targeted approach to dealing with low-income people, not second earners in many cases from other families and so on, you know, or young people trying to get their first job and all of that.
Mm. Mr. Eisenberg, what about that? I mean, what about that? This is on its face not a terribly efficient way to go about this, that you're actually kind of privatizing a public concern, if your overall public concern is offering sort of a minimal standard of living. There are better ways to do that. And also, the Democratic proposal is to double it, but that's still $4 an hour, just a little over $4 an hour.
It's to make the tip credit 70% of what will be a $10.10 minimum wage, so it would be $7, which is more than three times higher.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's important to remember that there are these eight states that require that employers pay the full minimum wage and not rely on tips. And is restaurant employment better or worse in those states? It's better. The National Restaurant Association itself has a 2014 growth forecast, and it projects a higher growth rate in the states that don't have any tip credit than in the ones that allow $2.13 to be paid. So I think that just obliterates the argument that this is going to have some bad effect on restaurant employment.
Michael Tanner?
Well, I think, first of all, you have to look at the overall economic conditions in those states. Those are, by and large, generally states that have lower unemployment levels to begin with, and there's other factors involved. You can't simply pull out the minimum wage and look at that. And, in fact, if you look at minimum wage studies generally across the board, Survey of the Literature suggests about 85% of those studies suggest that there's some loss of employment that goes on with minimum wage. If not, look, if the cost of labor has no impact on employment, let's have a $100 minimum wage. And be done with it. The fact is, everyone concedes that that would cost jobs. So if you're going to concede that, then you have to concede that there's going to be some marginal loss of employment if you increase or double or triple the minimum wage for restaurant workers.
I just want to mention that Mr. Tanner just happened to hit his mic a little bit. I don't want people to think we're beating him here. That it's not that kind of conversation. We're not having that kind of situation.
No violence.
No violence here in this conversation. So, Mr. Eisenberg, you know why? In a number of European countries, people who've gone overseas, everybody pays like a service fee. I mean, in some of the restaurants, when you have a party of a certain size, everybody automatically gets 20% attached to the bill, and as part of the way to ensure that people don't get stiffed, as it were. And I'm just wondering, or a value added tax or something like that. Has that kind of conversation ever been had in this country? And I was just wondering why not.
Well, in those countries, the employer does pay the full minimum wage. They don't rely on tips. And when you go to a restaurant in Europe, you're not expected to pay 20% or 15%. You know, if you give a little tip, it's something really extra. So The service, if there is a service fee, it goes to the restaurant, and then the restaurant pays the wage.
And I was just wondering if there has ever been that kind of conversation about adopting that system here to sort of regularize it. And I just wonder, because that doesn't seem to be part of our conversation. I just wondered why.
No, it's interesting. In California and Montana and Washington State, Oregon, some in Minnesota where they don't have the tip credit, people still do give tips. And so wages just are higher for the servers.
Well, I think people aren't aware necessarily of the difference in the tip credit, or I think they're not making their tip-based decisions on that. There has been some discussion about the whole idea of should we do away with tipping and simply have a wage for waiters and so on. The idea of tipping, of course, is to ensure better quality service, and there's debate about whether or not it actually achieves.
I guess what I'm
not.
Just wondering, is this a cultural practice that's just kind of ingrained in our culture, or is this an economic practice?
No, it's much more. I mean, Europe is beginning increasingly to move towards tips in countries that didn't used to tip for anything. Tipping is becoming more and more prevalent. I'd also mention the minimum wage is not universal in Europe. Germany, for example, and some other countries don't have minimum wages. And it's interesting that in countries that have minimum wages, youth unemployment is much higher than in countries that don't.
Can I get, we only have about 30 seconds left, Mr. Eisenberg. I just wanted to ask, can I persuade you to predict? This seems to be a popular, these are popular proposals right now. The polling indicates that most people in the public generally think it's a good idea. Do you hazard a guess about where this proposal is going?
Well, eventually the minimum wage will be increased. It's only a question of how long it will be. It's being increased in states one after another, and I think that the federal government will get there, if not this year, then next year.
We will see. Ross Eisenberg is vice president of the Economic Policy Institute. Michael Tanner is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. They were both kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Gentlemen, thank you both so much for joining us.
It was a lot of fun.
Just ahead, yeah, our heads are in college basketball, but we've got an eye on football. We'll talk about the latest in the fight by Northwestern University's football players to form a union. They scored a victory this week, and ESPN writer Pablo Torre will tell us more about it. And we'll talk to a player who's likely left millions on the table. He is retiring from the NFL at the age of 26.
There's a culture in the NFL, and I feel like it wasn't for me anymore.
Rashard Mendenhall joins us in an exclusive interview. That's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Marco Werman. Pope Francis was praised for condemning the mafia, but it's going to get complicated.
It may surprise you to learn, but in Italy, many, many mafiosi are religious.
Yeah, Italy's mafia dons are close to the church.
They like to think that they are acting in a cause higher than the cause of murder and greed.
What happens in Italy when the Pope gets tough on crime? Next time on The World.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square in Urbana, a lifestyle center which includes unique and independently owned specialty shops and restaurants like Pieto and Pieto 2, Tang Dynasty, and The Great Impasta.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Let's talk football now. The NFL's free agency period is in full swing. That means star players are switching teams and signing big money deals in the process. But one big name who will not be signing on the dotted line is running back Rashard Mendenhall. He played in 15 games for the Arizona Cardinals last year at the age of 26. You could say he's entering his prime, but Mendenhall says he is hanging up the cleats and he is not going after another job in football. And Rashard Mendenhall joins us now from Chicago. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for speaking with us because you've been relatively reticent about your decision. I mean, you didn't hold a press conference or anything like that. You did write about it for the Huffington Post. How come?
It seemed like it was more me. Even when I told my agent I was going to be walking away, and he asked me how I wanted to make the announcement, and I didn't think I needed to make an announcement, but I write for the Huffington Post, pretty regularly, so I decided to just kind of put my thoughts and feelings out there and put them truly.
The piece in the Huffington Post is very interesting. I mean, it covers a number of different points, but I want to pick a couple of lines from near the end of the piece where you say, So when they ask me why I want to leave the NFL at the age of 26, I tell them that I've greatly enjoyed my time, but I no longer wish to put my body at risk for the sake of entertainment. I think about the rest of my life, and I want to live it with much quality. And physically, I'm grateful that I can walk away feeling as good as I did when I stepped into it. Is that a big part of it, the desire to not be injured?
That's a small part of it, you know, because with football, there comes that risk and there comes that danger. And I think I just grew to a point where, you know, I've accomplished what I wanted to, and kind of ask yourself, what do you want to do going forward and why? And, you know, as an athlete, as a competitor, you kind of want to chase the pinnacle. You want to chase your height. And I've done that for some time. But it was starting to feel like, you know, when I say for the sake of entertainment, it was starting to feel like, is it really for that anymore? Is that what really matters?
You say in the same piece, I'm not an entertainer. I never have been. Playing that role was never easy for me. The box deemed for professional athletes is a very small box. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
You kind of always feel like you have to represent so many things all the time. And, you know, from the NFL and the Shield, from your personal team to the city that you live in. And by represent them, that doesn't necessarily mean be an upstanding citizen, because you can be that. But you kind of have to almost feel like be what they want you to be. You know, things that I greatly enjoy, you know, the arts and music and reading and dance and things like that. It would be questioned. You know, people would question, you know, what makes you a football player, or how serious you about your job. And it would kind of be frustrating, because I work very hard at my job and I work very diligently at everything that I do. But my interests outside of sports, I don't know why they were conflicting. I don't know why it would be a problem. And just kind of having to fit in that box, kind of having to dull myself to be accepted was a bit much for me on a regular basis.
Do you think that race plays a role in this? I mean, one of the other things that you wrote about in the piece is that there's an ugly side to the communications with the fans that perhaps other people don't see. You talked about the fact that you said, I can't even count how many times I've been called we don't use this word on the air, but a dumb, and it's the N-word. There's a bold coarseness you receive from non-supporters that seems to only exist on the internet. And you said it still shapes people's perceptions of you. So I guess I have a couple of questions embedded in that, right? But I do wonder if that small box has something to do with race in your view.
I definitely think so. I believe so. And you kind of feel it as you're going through from college to the NFL, because just in the same sense, there's a lot of players, you know, that aren't black that have outside interests, and they're kind of praised for that, because they're seen, for lack of a better way to put it, they're seen more as people or more as human beings. But being a black athlete, it's like you're just kind of assumed to not have anything besides football or besides sport. And it's kind of assumed that you would hold on to it for dear life.
Is the argument that you should just be so grateful to have the opportunity to play football that you shouldn't possibly be thinking about anything else?
Exactly. It's that you should be grateful and thank everybody for giving you the opportunity and for, you know, for being able to play the game. It is a great opportunity, but I think it goes both ways. You know, they get something out of it as well. You're exploited as well for your physical abilities, and it works both ways. But they make it one way a lot of the time, and especially for black players, the box you're in is a lot smaller.
Is that in part why you are leaving, or are you just
It's just a thing I noticed when I was going through. You know, I'm pretty perceptive. I've just kind of watched things and pay attention, and even just kind of being in a locker room, you know, there's just a difference. It is what it is. And there's a culture in the NFL and in that bubble or that realm, just like there is anywhere and everywhere. And I understand it, and I accepted it, and it was cool and it was fine. But I felt like it wasn't for me anymore.
I just feel like I have to ask, because I know that there are people who are listening who will want me to ask. There are people who just think you're crazy. They're thinking, how can you walk up? If you are healthy, you sound fine, like there's nothing bothering you, and you're walking away from what? Potentially millions of dollars, right?
Yeah.
So some people would, gee, that's like leaving a lottery ticket on the table.
But it's not. It's not winning the lottery. You have to work for that. And there's a lot that comes with that. And, you know, I think it only seems crazy to people who don't really know me. And I've known since I was younger that football would only last for a time. You have to stop it sometime. For some guys, it's after high school. Some guys after college. For some guys, after 10 years in the NFL. For some, it's after a few years in the NFL. And I always wanted to be able to, from when I was younger, from college, I remember going to the NFL, and I knew the second that, you know, I was ready to walk away that I would, no matter what was going on, no matter what was there. And anybody that knows me knows that, and they know that I've never found my whole identity in football. I've always known who I was as Rashard and grown in that. So stepping away from that is a piece of my life, but that's not the entire part of my life.
Did anybody try to talk you out of it?
Yes, definitely. But I'm not. It wasn't like I did it without any thought. You know, it took a lot of talking. And for somebody to talk me out of it, it would have taken a lot of talking.
Your agent didn't fall on his knees and start crying?
No. The only thing was, you know, being from Chicago, when one of my friends asked me, would you play for the Bears? And I was like, oh, that's interesting. But then I thought about how cold it is in Chicago and trying to play a game in January. And I said, nah, I'm straight.
You had one other thing I did want to mention. You mentioned a couple of things about disappointment with the way the game is going. You did have kind of like an old fogey moment in your piece. You know, these kids today who you say who don't want to work. You talked about one of your brothers, your older brother coaches football at the high school and youth level. And one day he called and said, these kids don't want to work hard. All they want to do is look cool, celebrate after plays and get more followers on Instagram. And you were saying that it actually is more like that than people might think. I mean, I'm interested in that just because, you know, we hear that. That's the opposite, right? We hear that those are the people who really celebrate it are people who, like yourself, have a work ethic and no showboat, you know, that things of that sort. You're saying that the way that the game is actually played is just not satisfying to you.
Yeah, I would say this. I didn't really say that I was disappointed or saying all these kids. I'm saying it's different from when I was in high school and college and kind of the way things were, kind of the way I saw it. I'm just saying it's different now. And, you know, with the entertainment aspect of it, with the 24-hour news cycle around the NFL, with the making of stories, with, you know, fans being able to connect to players and things like that on social media when they never have before, it is what it is, and it's great. It's great for everybody. It's brought so much more attention to the game. You know, there's a lot more revenue. People have a lot of fun with it. And it's just different. I would say for me, it's just different. And I wouldn't say one's greater than the other. But for me and what I kind of got into and what I signed up for, it's like, it isn't really for me. That's the best thing I can say. You know, for some people, it's perfect. For some people, it's great for them. But for me, it isn't really for me.
So what are you going to do with yourself?
A lot of things.
In the fall.
A lot of things. You know, I left school early. I wanted to finish school.
So are you, in fact, going to finish school? People always say they're going to, and they very rarely do. Are you going to?
You know what? I always said I wasn't going to. When I left school, I was always like, no, I'm not going to finish school. People tell me to finish school because I really didn't think it mattered or it was necessary, especially for what I would want to do and have a name. But I decided to go back and finish school, you know, to, you know, I put in all that time, might as well. And, you know, for the sake of credibility, to say I have my degree. So I decided I would finish school after all this time of saying that I wouldn't. And outside of finishing school, to really kind of grow at my writing. That's something I'm passionate about and something I've been doing this whole time and will continue to do going forward and continue to grow at. And wherever that goes, whatever happens with that, I'll be pleased with.
So art, writing, literature, dance. You could be an NPR host. Wait a minute. I'm talking myself out of a job here. Let's let this go. Well, congratulations on everything and good luck to you.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate that.
Rashard Mendenhall is retired as an NFL running back. He played for the Arizona Cardinals and the Pittsburgh Steelers, and he was kind enough to join us from Chicago. Rashard Mendenhall, thank you so much for speaking with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So now we turn to a decision that could shake up the world of college football, maybe all of college sports. We told you previously about a bid by the football players at Northwestern University to be declared employees of the college, arguing that college football is in fact a commercial enterprise that relies on the players' labor to earn profits. Yesterday, a regional director at the National Labor Relations Board ruled that football players receiving football grant in aid scholarship are in fact employees. It's a decision that puts the players one step closer to creating the nation's first college athletes union. We hope to have Pablo Torre join us. He's a senior writer for ESPN and a regular contributor to our Barbershop Roundtable, and he's with us now. Welcome, Pablo. Thanks so much
for
joining.
Hello, Michelle. Glad to be with you, as always.
So what does this mean? Is there now a union, or are there additional steps that have to be taken?
There are additional steps that have to be taken. This was the regional sort of center in Chicago of the National Labor Relations Board. The National Labor Relations Board, obviously the national level, will have something to say about this. Certainly, appeals will take this to federal courts, and maybe people are saying Congress will be involved because of the giant issues involved here, including antitrust. So right now, this is an enormous seismic step that, honestly, a lot of people in sports did not see happening. So this is already a victory for the Northwestern potential union, but there's still quite a bit to go.
Now, you know, Northwestern, of course, says it will appeal. The university wrote in a statement that it, quote, believes strongly that our student athletes are not employees but students. Unionization and collective bargaining are not the appropriate methods to address the concerns raised by student athletes. Now, presumably they made that argument already. What was the NLRB's response to that?
Yeah, the NLRB's response was that not all student athletes are created equal. I mean, that's the implication of what they're saying. They specifically began their verdict by noting the $235 million that was earned by the football program between 2003 to 2012. And the NCAA's best friend right now is all of these smaller sports. That's the cloak they're hiding under, the idea that there are all these other student athletes who aren't revenue generators, who aren't full-time employees, but the football players specifically, and certainly you can extrapolate this to the basketball players, those athletes are generating millions of dollars, billions of dollars when you take it to something like March Madness and the TV contract. So they are living in a completely different world, and that's what the NLRB was looking at, the unique status of revenue-generating athletes that really may change the face of college sports entirely as a result.
I think people, just by way of explanation, people might be wondering why it is that these student athletes wanted this or were pursuing this course of action. Earlier this year, we spoke with Ramoki Huma. He is president of the National College Players Association, which helps represent the players. And I asked him why they want a union, and this is what he said.
You know, these are players who, during games, if they're injured, the schools can still choose to stick them with the medical expenses, and they can lose their scholarships when they're injured. Obviously, graduation rates between football and basketball players hover around 50%, which is unacceptable. So over the years, it's become evident that unless players have a seat at the table, they're never going to have comprehensive reform and basic protections.
So this goes back to the question I asked you earlier. Do they now have that seat at the table?
Well, they definitely have more of a seat. The legitimacy and the permanence of that seat, I think, is what's up to legal appeal. But with the what they did, what Kane Coulter did, who is a former player at Northwestern, whomever you talk to, they were very smart. I mean, they realized a seat at the table is far more palatable if you're not explicitly talking about being paid like a pro athlete, for example, or even really being paid at all. What these guys did was notice, look, there are some very basic protections. We're talking about a money place of trust, for example, they could receive after they get their degrees. They're talking about health care, lifetime medical care. They're talking about some of the basic kind of human rights sort of issues that accrue to employees under a very, very wealthy employer, and that seems to be far more palatable to the American public and to appeals courts and to the judicial system than simply demanding, we are pro athletes, pay us like NFL players. They're not exactly doing that. So that table is a very strategic one that they're aiming for.
Tell me a little bit more about what the next steps are. And I understand this is very recent news, so you may not have had a chance to report this out, but I am interested in what reaction we're getting in the sports world to this development.
Well, the reactions in the sports world, people are surprised. A lot of people thought that this would not happen this way, that it wouldn't happen this early, for example, and it wouldn't be as seismic. I mean, the clear verbiage in the decision cited the money that was being accrued to these departments. They were talking about the economic benefits. They were talking about the 40 to 50 to 60 hours being spent by a college football player, which clearly delineated and the seismic change again about the other lawsuits that are assaulting the NCAA. That's the context of all this to be understood. The Ed O'Bannon lawsuit, which we've talked about previously on Tell Me More, that's slated to start this summer. We have Jeffrey Kessler, a sports labor specialist attorney. He's talking about forming a class of athletes to sue the NCAA and the ACC and the Big Ten and the SEC on antitrust grounds. All of those lawsuits will find better footing. They'll find purchase because of the success of the Northwestern potential union that's being formed right now. That is a huge change that will affect everything from how college sports are run financially and legally to how we watch them, what other sports maybe, you know, their impact will be on the other non-revenue generating sports. We may see a very different picture when we talk about Division I athletics because of this case.
Pablo Torre is a senior writer for ESPN. He's a regular contributor to our Barbershop Roundtable. He joined us from New York. Thanks, Pablo.
Thank you, Michelle.
Up next, Michael Peña takes the lead role in director Diego Luna's new biographical film about the farm workers' advocate Cesar Chavez, and he had to make quite the transformation for it.
When I had the meeting with Diego Luna, he says, "You need to gain like 30 pounds, man, please." And I was like, of muscle? Knowing that's not what he's going to say. And he's like, "No, just of like regular person." And I was like, oh, man.
Michael Peña talks about gaining weight and gaining a lot of knowledge to play the famed civil rights leader. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Joyce V. Hale, supporting NPR's internship program, Building a Future, One Opportunity at a Time. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to build a culture of health for all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. And from the estate of Joan Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Bryan Cranston. He plays LBJ in the new Broadway show All the Way.
Now you call yourself the leader of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party and show me some damn leadership!
That man scares me.
Not nearly as much as Walt. We'll talk with Cranston about acting and about his most famous character, Walter White, from Breaking Bad. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
I'm Diane Nolan, host of Mid-American Gardener. Join me this October on a bus trip to explore the Arkansas gardens of PBS host P. Allen Smith. We'll tour the grounds, enjoy a farm-to-table lunch, and we might even receive a visit from Allen himself. We'll also stop in Memphis and experience Beale Street. For more information, call 217-333-7300 or go to will.illinois.edu/willtravel.
Support for WILL comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the standard all-wheel drive Subaru Outback with an EPA highway rating of 29 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at their showroom on Route 45 in Savoy or at SubaruofChampaign.com.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're going to talk a bit more about football. The owners of Washington's professional football team, the Redskins, have been under intense pressure to change the name, which many people, especially many Native Americans, consider an offensive racial slur. Owner Daniel Snyder has so far refused to budge. Now, though, he has started a charitable foundation to help Native American tribes. There is controversy about that. So we're joined now by Mike Wise, who's been covering this. He's a columnist at the Washington Post. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, Michelle.
So tell us about the new foundation and how it was announced. It's interesting. I just want to mention for people who are interested, we did reach out to Mr. Snyder and members of his organization, and they declined to have anyone from the organization join our conversation.
Yeah, the organization is called the Original Americans Foundation. The notion was that, well, everybody knows why he went to Indian country the last 4 months. His name was under an assault. His brand was under an assault, and this is a charter member of the NFL. I think he wanted to make sure that he found out from the people that actually had the biggest stake in this what was going on. In those 4 months of trips, which include about 26, he and his people have decided to open up a foundation that has already included giving a backhoe to a tribe in Omaha and also 3,000 coats, and he promises more charitable donations, and he's actually put a person in charge of this this fundraiser.
So he says that he and some representatives visited, I don't know that he visited all of the tribes, but that he and members of his organization visited 26 tribes. There are more than 500 enrolled tribes in the United States, but he visited 26 tribes in Indian country. And from the letter that he posted, a lengthy letter on the Redskins website about this, saying that there are Native Americans everywhere that 100% support the name. He's quoting here the chair of the Torres Martinez Desert Coahuila Indians, and he says that this is what she told him when he came to visit her tribe, and quotes her further as saying, "I believe God has turned this around for something good." And he said that she told me it was far more important for us to focus on the challenges of education in Native American communities. And but you were, in your reporting, got a number of other perspectives. What were those?
Well, the most strong of which were mothers of Native American children who belong to a group, an online formed group called Eradicating Offensive Native Mascotry. And these are basically mothers and fathers of children who feel like there's a lot of self-esteem issues involved in it, and that their identity's been co-opted and stolen. And they echo, I mean, I don't want to say that Dan Snyder's just on the wrong side of history, but they've echoed every civil rights organization in this country, every Native American organization in this country has come out against the name. There is nobody standing pat. Now, there may be a divide on some of the reservations, but the divide, in my experience, I'm going to the Crow Agency in Montana, the Pine Ridge, every reservation I've been to in the last 7 years, the divide isn't we want this name and we're proud of it versus this is insulting and it messes with the self-esteem of our children. No, it's we don't want this name, and, well, we don't really care.
We don't really care.
We don't really care.
It's not a big
And I think that's a much different argument than there are no protests going on or change the or keep the mascot petitions circulating in America among Native Americans right now.
We only have about a minute left. What is your sense of whether this changes the dynamic of the debate at all? I don't know. Did he put a dollar figure to the level of contributions that he's planning to make here? But the letter seemed very heartfelt about what he understood about the conditions in many of these communities. Does this change the debate in your view?
I think it's another slap in the face to people who want the name gone, and I think it emboldens them more in many ways.
Why? Why do you say that?
I think they feel like this is essentially a rich man buying a poor people's silence. And as one of the mothers told me very candidly, the idea that we're supposed to choose between accepting funding that we need and our own identity is wrong.
Mike Wise is a columnist for The Washington Post. Clearly, this is a very rich and emotional topic, and we'll continue to follow it, as will you. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Now we turn to a new film that captures one of the greatest civil rights movements in America and the man who led it, Cesar Chavez.
3 days ago, I stopped eating. And I will continue to fast until everyone, and I mean everyone in our beautiful movement, makes a pledge recommitting themselves to nonviolence. Because we move forward together or not at all.
That was actor Michael Peña as Cesar Chavez. The activist organized farm laborers and fought to secure a living wage and better working conditions in the field. He was one of the founders of the United Farm Workers Union in California in the 1960s, and his work inspired millions of people in the U.S. and around the world. The film opens nationwide tomorrow, and Michael Peña is with us now. He's with us from NPR West, which is in Culver City, California. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
People are always interested in how people find these kinds of roles. Did you hear about it and just want to be part of it? Did they come looking for you, or how did it work?
Oddly enough, I was asked at Comic-Con the year before anybody even talked about this movie. They said, you know, if you had a dream role, what would it be? And it was just a snap answer. I just said, you know, it'd be great to play Cesar Chavez, but I don't know much of his story. 9 months later, I got an email saying that Diego Luna wants to meet about Cesar Chavez. And my first question was like, is it the pugilist or is it the civil rights activist? And they said the civil rights activist. And I said, wow, that's fantastic. So then I met him. I had to audition 3 times for it.
What did you know about him and what did you come to find out?
I have to be honest with you. I mean, growing up with 2 parents that are farm workers, not farmers, the only thing that I knew about him were the streets that were named after him, the schools that were named after him, and a little bit of the story that he worked with farm workers. And that's basically about it, which kind of, you know, put a little more fire. Me, I'm a Mexican-American, and I don't know about one of the biggest heroes that we have. That gave me, added motivation to tell this guy's story.
What were some of the things you found out in the course of preparing for the role? And is there anything that surprised you?
You know, it didn't surprise me that he was like a vegetarian. He actually loved all these vegetables that he was fighting for the workers that, you know, that picked them. But also he was a devout Christian. He read a lot about Gandhi. But the thing that really, I guess, surprised me was here was a guy who was just a strategist, and he was asked to lead the movement because all his ideas were very practical and very good, you know, at the meetings. I don't know about you, but for me, if I got to present any kind of award, I'm shaking in my pants. I'm like, you guys, if you ever see the Academy Awards, you see a lot of the big names just get things wrong because that's not the most natural thing to do is to do some public speaking, and that's what this guy was asked to do.
One of the things that I thought that's difficult is that there are still a lot of people around who knew him. And I wonder how difficult it is to portray someone that a lot of people do know.
Well, I think the best compliment that I could ever get was, you know, his son gave me a hug and said, yep, that was my dad. It was difficult to be honest with you, and, you know, as an actor playing a person that's very humble and maybe wasn't the best public speaker, probably like the opposite of what some of the politicians are today, where there's a lot of beautiful talk and they get reelected somehow, and then you see their statistics and they're very low and they haven't accomplished much. And here's Cesar Chavez, who accomplished a lot and spoke very little. So there was a lot of pressure with that. But I think, you know, when his son said that to me, I was very excited and very pleased.
How did you go about preparing? I understand that you actually gained a few pounds for the role.
Well, I gained 30 pounds for the part, and I was in really good shape after I finished this movie, End of Watch. And when I had the meeting with Diego Luna, he says, you need to gain like 30 pounds, man, please. And I was like, of muscle, knowing that's not what he's going to say. And he's like, no, just of like regular person. And I was like, oh, man. You know, I did gain the weight, and thank God that I did, because I, you know, this was a man who wasn't prone to violence, and if I looked like a Hollywood actor guy that was, like, in really good shape, then it doesn't look real, and it's not real. And then I actually shaved, like, a little gap in between my teeth. The way he said S's, a lot of the air passed through it. It really informed the way that he spoke, and that was the other thing that I learned. I learned a little bit of organizing. I went to some of the meetings. I actually picked a lot of grapes, you know, just to have a memory of what it's like and what you're actually fighting for and to see the people that I'm working with. Mm. And then also, I started working on his voice. I noticed that there was like a different tone in everyone's voice and also a different rhythm. And to me, that was important because we were doing a film about this man who actually was born in the 30s and 40s, or actually lived life in the 30s and 40s. And you know, a lot of people spoke like this, you know, where, you know, everything was very, the syncopation was very exact, and the rhythm and tone was very deliberate. So I started doing that for, I don't know, maybe a month straight. Then it started becoming my own.
What did you come to understand about what motivated him?
With this part, what I started looking at is a social injustice in our time, and try to make it as personal as possible so that when you act this kind of thing, you can have some semblance of truth. And for me, it was pretty easy. It was like, you know, it mirrored the same kind of situations that were happening to Chavez. My brother and my father both got laid off around the same time that I was starting to do this movie, Chavez. And at the same time, it was when all the bailouts were happening. And so it was very similar to these guys that were big business taking advantage of the little guy. And I just wasn't okay with that. And then I heard about these guys giving themselves huge bonuses when, in actuality, they were not good at their job. Their statistics were down tremendously, enough so that they would be bankrupt. And then when they get a bailout, which means that us taxpayers were actually paying for it, they decided to give themselves bonuses. That kind of filled me with resentment towards these people because it affected me directly, which is exactly what I think, that's how Chavez felt to these people bullying people that didn't have a voice.
What do your dad and your brother do? Were they in the same field?
No, my brother was actually working at a bank, and he was working at a bank for maybe 13 years. I started working at a bank. You know, our parents taught us math at an early age, and we excelled at that. And my father and mother were working at factories.
And they're both laid off at the same time. That must have been really upsetting.
Yeah, my mother's not with us anymore, my brother and my father both got laid off at the same time. So you could imagine I'm having to lend my older brother and father money. These are people that have tremendous sense of pride, and here they are, like, you know, indirectly but directly, I know exactly what they meant, having to suck up their pride and say, like, hey, buddy, I'm going to pay you back in 2 months, trust me. And you never want to ask your little brother for money. And knowing how hard it was for my brother to do that, it just never sat right with me, and that's the fuel that I used to play Chavez.
The film, you know, describes a lot of the politics of the time and also some of the nuts and bolts of organizing, but it also describes something that I think a lot of people are curious about, which is what effect a job like that has on a family. One of the moments in the film, I just want to play this clip, is from Cesar Chavez having to negotiate between the movement and his family, and you're devising a strategy to get arrested during the 1960s grape boycott in Delano, California. And then the film also depicts the fact that your wife, who's played by America Ferrera, who plays Chavez's wife Helen, is also an activist. And here's also a scene involving Rosario Dawson, who plays the activist Dolores Huerta. And here it is. And you're laughing, and I know why. Here it is. Here's the clip.
I'll get arrested.
Well, you can't get arrested.
What? Why not?
Well, who's going to take care of the kids?
The kids are fine. They're big. They take care of themselves.
No.
Cesar, you're the one who says we can't ask our members to do things we're not willing to do ourselves.
I said no.
Dolores, what do you think?
I think it's a good idea.
I think it's a good idea, too.
Cesar did not think it was a good idea. How closely do you think that hewed to the reality of the situation?
That's one of the things that, you know, research really comes into play. We went to go visit Helen and, you know, Cesar's wife. You know, a lot of times, regardless of how strong the man appears to be, it's the, you always got to get the yes or the no from the wifey. And that's one of those instances where she actually got her way and she was actually arrested. I couldn't believe that this little, like, cute little woman actually did that, you know? I was really surprised. She told me, like, it was, like, you know, almost how Chavez was, where, yeah, it's something that I had to do and that's what I did, you know? And I said, so you got arrested? And she's like, and I was put in jail. And I was like, wow. These are regular people that really went out of the way to do something that they thought was right.
One of the things that I think a lot of people may not remember that the film makes clear is that even if people remember that there was a great boycott, I don't think many people necessarily remember just how long this went on. And I just want to play a short clip that speaks to that. And here it is.
5 years we were on strike. But it kept us sacrificing and fighting for a better tomorrow. A better tomorrow that we all dream about as we worked amongst these beautiful vines. And when millions and millions of Americans stopped doing one thing, eating grapes, we won the strike! We won! We won! Si se puede!
So what do you want people to draw from this film?
I kind of, I guess, the way that it woke me up in a way, like, you know, to be honest with you, I wasn't much of a voter. I didn't think my voice was important, even though I'm, you know, I'm an actor and some people know me. And, you know, I didn't want to be ridiculed for what I believe in. But then I couldn't believe that those were my thoughts in actuality. Like, I don't know what I'm going to get involved in, to be honest, but we can start by voting and getting into just knowing the very basics of politics and knowing who to follow. And for me, that's a good beginning that I never had. But also to get involved and know that your voice can be strong, and in numbers, it's even stronger.
Michael Peña plays the title role in the new film Cesar Chavez. It opens nationwide on Friday. Michael Peña, thanks so much for joining us, and congratulations.
Thank you much.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.